Into it. Last Sunday, I spent the morning talking about how we should approach narratives in the Old Testament, what our takeaway should be when we read them. We spent a lot of time on that. And this was actually part of introducing our next series, which is on the Old Testament books of history, which begins next Sunday. A few years ago, we spent several weeks on in the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament. And following the Pentateuch is this next section, commonly referred to as the books of Old Testament history. So we have 13 of these. We've talked about this before here, from Joshua to Ruth. Together, they cover roughly a 1,000-year period of Israel's history, all of which are written in the form of historical narrative. And most of the Bible is written in narrative form, and this section here is by far the largest chunk of narrative. So I'm not going to take time to review last Sunday, but given that it was Labor Day, we had a number of folks who weren't with us, so I would just encourage you that if you did miss, that you'd pick it up on YouTube or our website or whatever, podcasts, and because that information should prove to be helpful as we proceed through this series. So today what I want to do is zoom out and get kind of a grasp of how the events in these 13 books play out chronologically, how they fit together, and how they fit into the larger context of the Old Testament itself. So this will be kind of a quick flyover, if you will, a view from 20,000 feet up for the most part. And then next Sunday, we will start into the individual books themselves. So here's what you can expect in the weeks to come. Steve Long will begin with Joshua. And the following week, Dave Stevens will take Judges. Kerry Warren has Ruth on the last Sunday of the month. We'll take a short break on the first two Sundays of October for guest speakers, and that would be Sean and Mike from Salina, who used to serve here as pastors. John Shutt will resume the series on October 20th with 1 Samuel, and then Nate Elkington the Sunday after that with 2 Samuel, and then Nate Hubbard and Guy Platter taking 1 and 2 Kings. I will address 1 and 2 Chronicles on November 17th. And Josh Miles will follow up with Ezra and Nehemiah, and Tim and Heather will finish up with Esther on December 8th. So there you have it. To all this, I should say, as the Lord wills. So that gives you kind of a scope of what lies ahead here. So if some things sound familiar this morning, and they probably will, that's because I'm borrowing material from two different sermons that I gave a while back. And if you are like me, reviews are helpful because we tend to forget a lot, especially with information that we don't use on a regular basis, and I was surprised how much I had forgotten from my own sermons, but I guess that is to be expected now that I have officially advanced, now that I'm 70, I've officially advanced from a senior citizen to now an elderly person, so. And because in addition to the senior citizen discount that I've always have enjoyed, I now have someone who greets me at the door wanting to know if I need assistance with the wheelchair, so. That's how it works. Just kidding. All right, let's dive into it. Today is going to be kind of like a crash course in Old Testament history. It's going to be a lot of information. Most of it, again, you will be probably familiar with. But my objective this morning, specifically, is to organize it into time periods so that we can keep better track of what goes where. So if you are a visitor, our style here tends to be a little different than maybe what you're used to. It's more of a teaching environment, more for the purpose of learning. Think of this as a big classroom. All right, so there are a number of ways that we could divide the chronology of the Old Testament, but I would propose a fairly simple method of just seven time periods. And these should be pretty easy to remember, especially if you have even a basic knowledge of the Old Testament. And we can use something like this chart to illustrate it, and keep in mind that this is not drawn to scale. So we have beginnings. Okay, let me back up. I have the slides wrong, but we'll work around it. We have beginnings, we have patriarchs. I'll work through this, you'll see it all. We have the sojourn, conquest, settlement. We have the united monarchy. We have the divided monarchy. We have the exile. And then we have the return and the second temple, Jerusalem. All right, went through that real quick, but we're going to spend a little time on each one of those. The tricky part is that the books in the Old Testament that cover these time periods don't fit into those slots all that neatly. This is where it gets a little tricky. For instance, a book like Joshua focuses on relatively a short period of time of about 25 to 30 years, whereas Judges, the book that immediately follows, covers around 330 years. And some books, like 1 Chronicles, spans across more than one of those time periods. And however, there is, I believe, value in matching all that up, and we'll do that the best we can, and that's the attempt this morning. So let's get into it. The first one here is Beginnings. This is pretty obvious. This is the first 10 and a half chapters of Genesis. And the key events here will be, and you know them, the creation of the universe, pretty obvious, creation of Adam and Eve. Excuse me, I'm overcoming a cold, and I'm just can't catch my breath very well. The mandate given to them to fill the earth and exercise dominion over it. Of course, the fall, the first murder, Cain kills Abel, the human race then descends into sin, God's decision then to start over, the building of the ark and the flood, God's covenant with Noah, and the Tower of Babel. These are the main events in that. The period ends with God calling Abraham, and we would roughly date this around, you know what, I did have him right, I just didn't do it right. Here we go. All right. The period ends with God calling Abraham around 2000 B.C., the period begins with the act of creation, but we can't really ascribe a date to that. Many have tried to postulate a date based on the genealogies in the Bible, but if you will remember Josh Birch's sermon on this a while back, there are problems with that approach. On that note, the dates that I will be offering from this point on are, they tend to be a subject of some debate, and so I'm just providing them here as rough estimates. Essentially, I'm going with traditional dating from sources that are theologically conservative. All right, the next would be the period of the patriarchs, and this would be the rest of Genesis, the last two-thirds of that book, and the first part of Exodus. So again, it starts with Abraham, the father of the Jews. Other key players would include, of course, his son, who is Isaac, all right, and Isaac's two sons, Jacob and Esau, and Jacob's 12 sons who become the 12 patriarchs of the 12 tribes of Israel. We should all know this. Key events in this time period include God's covenant with Abraham, the institution of circumcision, destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, birth of Isaac's sons, of course, Esau and Jacob, transfer of birthright from Esau to Jacob, very significant. Then we have the birth of Jacob's 12 sons, selling of the favorite son into Joseph, selling the favorite son Joseph into slavery, Joseph ascending to the second in command over Egypt, Joseph's reunion to his family, and then they all move to Egypt, and rapid and prolific multiplication of Jacob's family in Egypt, Egyptians feeling threatened about this and forcing him into slavery for 400 years, and then we have the birth of Moses and Moses growing up as an Egyptian. So we date this from about 2000 BC to around 1500 BC. We could have made the 400-year period of slavery a separate time slot. Some chronologies you will see will do that, but according to the Pentateuch, nothing really all that significant happens during that period except that they multiply and serve the Egyptians as slaves. All right, ready for the third period. Just moving along here. We have the sojourn, conquest, settlement. This period is described in the rest of Exodus, most of that book, all the way to the end of Ruth. So most of the Pentateuch and into the first three books of the Old Testament of history, we have Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, and Ruth. So this is a large section of the Old Testament, and a lot happens. Moses confronts Pharaoh. We got the 10 plagues. We have the institution of the Passover. Moses leads the Israelites out of Egypt, crosses the Red Sea. Moses receives the 10 commandments from God on Mount Sinai. We have the building of the tabernacle, the order to march into Canaan, take possession of it as God's promise to them. The response, however, is fear and disobedience, thus 40 years wandering in the desert. After this, that disobedient generation dies out. And now under Joshua, they cross the Jordan and begin the campaign to take Canaan, starting with Jericho. After this, there are a number of conquests, various struggles, even failures, mostly conquests. Then we have the era of the judges, and finally the birth of Samuel, who's the prophet, priest, judge, and military leader of Israel. And we date this period roughly 1500 to about 1050 BC. Okay? Now, because of this time period is covered by three books in our series, Joshua, Judges, and Ruth. We'll take a moment now to just show how they correspond. Joshua, of course, is named after... Very good. See how smart we are. And he's the right hand of Moses. You know him. With the death of Moses, the time has finally come for Israel to cross the Jordan River, take possession of the promised land, and promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This book tells us the story of how they did so and the lessons they learned, or at least should have learned from that experience. And it can be divided up neatly into two halves. The first half, chapters 1 through 12, describe resounding military victories at Jericho, Ai, Gibeon, Hazar, and numerous other cities. It's an action-packed page-turner. The second half, chapters 13 through 24, is more sedentary. A mood prevails there. It's a meticulous account of how the land of Canaan was parceled out among the tribes of Israel. It's not quite the page-turner. There's lots of details regarding family names, geography that most of us would not be familiar with, but would have been familiar to the original reader, and the chapters themselves would, of course, been of crucial importance to them. So for us, the value is seeing how all of this contributes to the bigger picture of God's plan. You'll remember this from last week, in his faithfulness to execute that plan. It's all an important piece of Israel's history and an important piece in redemption history. All right, along this line, the book of Judges opens up with great optimism. Though Joshua has now died, the people of Israel seem to be exactly where God intended them to be. The promised land of Canaan has all been but conquered. The territory has been divided up among the 12 tribes of Israel. There's a lot here to be, you know, this is all looks good. And there's just not that much that remains, just some minor cleanup here and there. Joshua had faithfully exhorted the people to reject the Canaanites' false gods and instead to faithfully and exclusively worship Yahweh, the God of Israel. And the people had emphatically affirmed that they would do so. This was God's people under God's care and God's land. Again, a note of optimism begins. And many readers see the book of Judges as a continuation of that optimism and promising situation, a collection of stories about heroes of the faith and courage of those who let God to do amazing things through them in the worst of circumstances. After all, we have Gideon and Samson, that kind of thing. But looking at the book as a whole, we quickly see that it is not a simple story about courage and heroism. In fact, the 21 chapters of Judges depict the gross, disturbing, and unrelenting slide of Israel into sin, idolatry, civil war, and utter chaos. There's a downward spiral pattern of the book, and each cycle, the people found themselves at a darker, more awful level of depravity. One could even say that the last three chapters of this book are the darkest in the entire Bible. The cycle, again, is clear. Israel deserts God for a pagan deities. God then allows them to suffer at the hands of the Canaanites. Israel cries out to God for help. God sends a deliverer. All is well again until the pattern of infidelity starts up again and again and again. And if there is a statement in this book that captures the whole picture, it would be this. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And that observation on the part of the author is repeated several times in those last chapters. So the book is named Judges, pointing to those who led Israel between Joshua, the great military leader, and Saul, Israel's first king. And it seems that the primary task of a judge was that of protecting Israel from her enemies, and so they were military leaders and establishing justice like the judges of modern-day courts, you might say. All right, the next logical book in the sequence chronologically in this time period here would be First Samuel, for it picks up where Judges leaves off, but instead it is Ruth, and that's because the events described in Ruth take place during the time of the Judges, and so it makes sense to place it there. But like the book of Esther, its focus is not on that of documenting the history of Israel itself, rather it's an account of a particular story. And on face value, the Book of Ruth seems to be nothing more than a love story about a down-and-out girl who is saved from destitution and swept off her feet by a rich, handsome stranger. But as it unfolds, we begin to see how the events fit into God's ultimate plan. Again, the period during the Book of Judges was a dark time for the Israelites, and they aimlessly floundered around in sin and idolatry and disobedience to God. But even in this, God remained faithful. He was still keeping his promises. Very important to remember this. He had promised them a king, and through Ruth's family line would come that king. Obed, the son of Ruth and Boaz, would turn out to be the grandfather of David. And from the line of David comes who? Jesus, the Messiah himself. So out of the hopeless chaos we see in the Book of Judges, here in the story of Ruth, we see God at work. We find hope. And that is one of the main takeaways of that book. All right, everyone following me so far? Number four, the fourth period we call the United Monarchy. The events here are recorded for us in 1 and 2 Samuel and in the first half of 1 Kings. And some of the events are also found in 1 and 2 Chronicles. We can sum the United Monarchy up with the first three kings of Israel. This is what should come to mind when you think of the United Monarchy. We have the first king who is... Then, there you go. All right. These are the glory days, but yet things are still turbulent and troublesome. Some of the more major events during this time period, the United Monarchy include, of course, Samuel anointing Saul to be the first king. Saul proves to be unfit for the job. God rejects him, chooses David. David is crowned king after the death of Saul. With David, the actual dynasty begins. He conquers Jerusalem, makes it Israel's capital. He recovers the Ark of the Covenant and brings the tabernacle into the city and starts plan for the construction of the temple. All of this, along with his slaying of Goliath as a young boy, cements his kingship in people's minds. It becomes clear that he enjoys the favor of Yahweh. Also in this period, as we know, David sins in a big way. He commits adultery and then commits murder to cover up his adultery. We also have the rebellion of David's son Absalom. God punishes David for numbering his people. Solomon becomes king upon David's death. God blesses Solomon for seeking divine wisdom. Solomon builds a temple for God. Solomon succumbs to a life of hedonism and sexual promiscuity, marries hundreds of foreign women who lead him away from God and into idol worship, and even the worship of the detestable gods of Molech and Chemosh. Deities worshipped by human sacrifices. And this period ends when Rehoboam, Solomon's son, David's grandson, becomes king upon Solomon's death. So we could date this time period from 1050 to 950 BC. So a few words here about the Old Testament books that cover this period. 1 and 2 Samuel are named after Samuel, the prophet, priest, judge, and military leader who anointed both Saul and David. According to Jewish tradition, Samuel was the primary author of these two books, and originally it was one volume, not two. The working theory here is that the whole unit was too big to fit on one scroll, or it was too cumbersome to use, and so it was divided into two parts for the sake of convenience. In 1 Samuel, we have the account of how God took his struggling and directionless people, a loose confederation of 12 tribes, out of the dark, chaotic time of the Judges, and brought them into and established for them a monarchy, and they are now a kingdom with a king, King Saul. And Saul is the primary subject in 1 Samuel. Unfortunately, he proves to be unfit and is a major disappointment. David, the primary subject of 2 Samuel, was much more in line with what God had intended, but as we know, he too had his share of sins and failures. So the narratives in both books are somewhat the most are some of the most interesting reading in the Old Testament. We have a sweeping epic full of war and intrigue, suspense and humor, tragedy and triumph, fascinating stories, powerful characters, you know, interpersonal conflicts, armies marched, flags waved, swords clashed, giants were slain, and kings rose and fell. The pages are filled with stories of betrayals, rape, adultery, sons rebelling against their fathers, siblings attacking each other, kings being disgraced, and even the chaos and heartbreak of civil war. There's just a lot going on, very colorful, very action-packed. And as we consider the larger picture of God's plan, we see that in the Samuels, God made promises that would reverberate all the way through to the New Testament, and into the rest of history, especially in regards to David's throne and dynasty, all of which pointed to the coming Messiah. God is able and determined to keep his promises of both blessing and judgment. All right, this time period extends into the first half of 1 Kings. It begins with David's final days leading up to his death, and then shortly after this, Solomon's ascension to the throne. Solomon, as you will remember, started off with great promise. He was blessed by God with profound wisdom, builds a great temple for God. Unfortunately, his final years, he ends up in a life of debauchery and idol worship. After his death, most of Israel rejects his son Rehoboam as king and no longer want anything to do with the dynasty of David. Thus, we end up with a divided kingdom, a divided monarchy. And this brings us to the next period. The united monarchy is followed by the divided monarchy. This is covered in the second half of 1 Kings to the first half of 2 Kings and also in the last two-thirds of 2 Chronicles. All right, so Rehoboam, Solomon's son, leads with a heavy hand, and as a result, 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel reject him as king, and they split off. And they reside in the northern part of the land and retain the name Israel, and their first king was, who remembers his name? Jeroboam, okay? Several more kings followed him in the coming years, none of whom were faithful to God. All of them were bad. Meanwhile, Rehoboam presides over the southern kingdom, which includes the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. This southern kingdom was commonly referred to as Judah and included the city of Jerusalem. And many kings came after him as well, most of whom were bad, but there were some good ones. Good kings that you would recognize included Jehoshaphat, Hezekiah, and Josiah. Other key figures during this time period include the two great prophets named Elijah and Elisha, all right, and we would date this period of the divided monarchy from 950 to 700 BC. So when you read the account in 1 Kings of the 10 northern tribes splitting off, this is all very significant in Israel's history here, we should note the significance of what they say. In chapter 12, verse 16, this is their proclamation. Down with the dynasty of David. I mean, think about that. You know, this is God's promise to them. Down with the dynasty of David. We have no interest in the son of Jesse. Back to your homes, O Israel. Look out for your own house, O David. You're on your own. You don't have us anymore. And from that day on, the 12 northern tribes refused to be ruled by any descendant of David. And in so doing, they reject the privileges and blessings God promised to David's house. And all this is worth remembering. However, there would be times when Israel and Judah would temporarily joined together in some military endeavor. But other than that, they were not buddies. So like 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, those books were originally one volume. They can be both difficult and fascinating to read. One of the difficulties comes from the sheer number of unfamiliar names, especially after Israel splits into two. It's hard to keep up with who is reigning where and when. If you've read that book, it can be a little hard to follow. Now, this isn't made any easier by the fact that the northern kingdom, with its capital in Samaria, continues to be called Israel, while the southern kingdom, with its capital in Jerusalem, is therefore called Judah. So that can be a little confusing. But once we push through the unfamiliar names and the difficult timeline and geography, that sort of thing, Kings is an action story. Unfortunately, it's an action story that is headed toward disaster. Not only do we find Israel divided into two nations, but each of those two nations fall to foreign powers, and most are taken captive into exile. The chaos and disaster is reminiscent of what we saw in the book of Judges. King after king has disobeyed God's word, worshipped idols even to the point of sacrificing their own children to these idols, and have led their people into the same kinds of sins. And you'll see some of the wickedest men and the wickedest women in all of Israel's history here in this book. On the other hand, we also meet two of Israel's greatest prophets, Elijah and Elisha. So it becomes clear that the author has an agenda. He wants his readers to know why judgment fell on God's people. This is why the book is written. You know, why Israel lost its unity, why it fell to the Assyrians and the Babylonians, why the throne of David was empty, and why they were taken into exile. God did not abandon them, like many complained. Rather, they abandoned God. That's the point of reading 1 and 2 Kings. But even in the tragedy of judgment and exile, God continues to speak to his people through a series of prophets. The basic message from heaven is, in spite of it all, I will save you. All right, so now for Chronicles, also in this time period, like Samuel's and Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles were originally one volume. From even a casual reading of the Old Testament, it becomes obvious that it covers a lot of the same stories that we find in the Samuels and in the Kings, so much so that some might wonder why we even have Chronicles. I mean, why two separate accounts of that period in our Bibles? Well, the answer would be similar to why we have four Gospels. Each were written for different readers, and each has a somewhat different purpose. The Kings, try to keep the difference here, were written during the Babylonian exile, and the purpose was to show the Jews that it was because of their hard-heartedness and sin that led them to their downfall and depravity. So put that in this spot. And over here, Chronicles, on the other hand, was written after the exile was over, after the Jews had returned to their homeland. And it focuses more on the restoration of Israel and its promising future. And the underlying message is that they must now adhere to God's ways and remain faithful to him. The first nine chapters of Chronicles outline a lengthy and detailed multi-branch genealogy that traces the family lines of all the 12 tribes of Israel, from Adam to the returned exiles of Israel. And this served as concrete evidence of God's unending and unbroken faithfulness. It may be boring for us to read, but that's its purpose, to show us God's faithfulness in all of this. The rest of 1 Chronicles and all of 2 Chronicles contain stories that we do find in Samuel's and Kings, but they're listed here again to serve as reminders of God's faithfulness. He has a specific purpose in mind, to exalt the Davidic kingship as the one true kingship of Israel, and so the episodes he chooses to include are the ones most fitted to that task, the one that author chooses to include. So the takeaway of 1 and 2 Chronicles should be clear enough. There are reasons to be hopeful. God is keeping his promises, and an heir of David will occupy David's throne again. All right, everyone keeping all this straight? I know it's a lot of information. Does it feel like a fire hose? All right, good. Does it feel like a dripping water faucet? How many think it's a dripping water faucet? How many think it's a fire hose? How many have already taken my permission to fall asleep? Number six, moving on to the next period. This is the exile. This is a period that we're probably not that familiar with, but it's important in Israel's history. It's important in redemption history. We need to be aware of it, familiar with it. This is covered in the second half of 2 Kings. Though it is common to use the language of the exile, those words are almost always used to refer to both exiles that happened at about the same time. There's really two. The first exile is when the northern kingdom, Israel, falls to the Assyrians in 722 and are taken captive. Many are deported to Assyria and are absorbed into its people and culture, and we never hear from them again. And they are often referred to as the lost 10 tribes of Israel. Ultimately, they got what they wanted. They wanted nothing to do with the house of David, and so they are assimilated, integrated, lost into society and culture of their enemies, the Assyrians. And the Assyrians, they were ruthless, cruel, resistance was futile, like the Borg, you know, you remember that? That was them. All right, then the second exile happens around 130 years later, 586. This is when the southern kingdom, which is called Judah, suffers a similar fate, but not as severe. They are taken captive by the Babylonians, and many are deported to Babylon. King Nebuchadnezzar, you will remember him, he orders Solomon's temple to be ransacked and destroyed. And then some folks, by choice, are integrated into Babylonian culture, but many of them faithfully maintain their identity and customs and allegiance to Yahweh, at least to some degree. And we would date this period roughly from 700 to 550 BC. And now, finally, the seventh period. And this would be the return from exile. And this is covered in Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. So the Persians have now conquered both the Assyrians and the Babylonians. And its king, who can, for the trip to Hawaii, the $5,000 cash, and what is behind door number two over there, who can tell me who that king is? Who? Good guess. Cyrus? King Cyrus. He permits Jews to return to their homeland. This takes place in three main stages that stretched out over a 100-year period. And this period also includes what historians refer to as the Second Temple Judaism, if you hear that expression, or post-exilic Judaism. Did I pronounce that right? Exilic? Did I say that right that time? I'm not going to say it again because I won't get it right twice in a row. Upon their return, under leaders like Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah, the nation is reestablished. But nation is kind of a strong word here. They are not really a nation. They are not independent. They are allowed to rebuild their temple along with the wall of Jerusalem and establish themselves as a people. But and at some point they will, you know, I mean, they do assume the name Israel once again, but they are still under a king. So we would date this from 550 to 400. Chronologically, the Old Testament ends with the final chapter of Nehemiah, chronologically. So that's worth noting for a future quiz. So a few words on the books of Ezra and Nehemiah that cover this period. Like others, they were originally one volume. Ezra picks up immediately where 2 Chronicles leaves off with the decree of King Cyrus. And together they tell the story of how the returned exiles tried to rebuild Jerusalem from the ashes through constant opposition from their adversaries and political setbacks and maneuverings and periods of great discouragement. They finally rebuild a temple and they raise again the walls of the city. I think you're familiar with the story. Upon this, the Jews try very hard to celebrate what has been accomplished. The very presence of the Israelites in their own land again is evidence of God's continuing faithfulness to them. It's a wonderful thing. Who could have ever expected this? And who would ever expected the temple to have been rebuilt? So they want to celebrate this. But the celebration rings a little hollow. For one thing, the temple is smaller. It's far less impressive than the one Solomon had built. The wall around Jerusalem is a modest copy as well. Furthermore, the Jews are not really independent. They are still subjects to a foreign king, the king of Persia. There is no heir of David ruling over Israel as her king. Nothing here can be compared to the glory days of King David and King Solomon. Even the prophecies of Isaiah, which provided them great hope, seem to have promised something far more glorious than what they are now experiencing. At the completion of the wall, the people gather to hear Ezra read and explain the law, and to remember their own sin as a nation and to thank God for his faithfulness. And upon hearing Ezra read from the scriptures, they are convicted. They repent to the point of weeping bitterly when you read the account, and they rededicate themselves to God and his law. They even divorce their foreign wives and send them back to Persia. It's quite a step of repentance. But as to be expected, this revived zeal to serve Yahweh eventually erodes, and they fall into disobedience and sin again. It's just an ongoing cycle. God had indeed kept his promise to return the people to their land. There's no doubt about that, but surely this was not the culmination of God's purposes and plans, nor the fulfillment of many of the prophecies. And it becomes obvious that God had a greater purpose in mind than a return from exile and a temple that wasn't all that impressive. So you can kind of see how all this leads up to the big picture. All right. And now for Esther. Esther's contribution, again, isn't that of documenting really that much of Israel's history. It is included here because the events described in it take place during that time period. And it's a story about Jews being held in captivity in Persia. Some Jews had been allowed to return. Others, like the ones referred to in this book, have not, or they've have chosen not to. It provides the reader an inspirational story of God's faithfulness, of how he is at work, even when it seems at the moment that he is far off and distant. It is a compelling record of God's providential care for the Jewish people. So the setting is the Persian capital of Susa, I think I'm saying that right, during the reign of Xerxes I. The narrative, again, is wildly entertaining. You know the story. It's complete with drama, suspense, unexpected turns of fate, even humor. One of the things that makes the story so intriguing is that God is never mentioned in the book, and not a single miracle takes place in the whole story. Even so, the exquisite timing of events, the coincidences and complete reversals of fortune that take place make it clear that God is in complete control and is working behind the scenes in a powerful and unexpected way. And the people of Israel were saved from destruction by the courage of a queen, by the impressive cunning of a cousin, and of course, by the sovereign hand of God. We all know the story, correct? All right. So that's the general sweep of Old Testament history, Old Testament 101 in 35 minutes. And after this is what we call the intertestament period, about a 400-year stretch between the Old Testament and New Testament. So hopefully this information was helpful, maybe very helpful, maybe not so helpful at all, maybe somewhat, I don't know. But I'm guessing that the three areas of the Old Testament where many of us might be a little weak in would be the divided kingdom, the exile, and how the prophets fit in with all that. Would that be fair to say? Okay, so this is why at some point we want to do a series on the Old Testament prophets and get all that, see how all that fits together with this. And we kind of have penciled that in for the summer of 2026. I don't know, if we can do that by then, but that it's on the radar. And again, as the Lord wills. So, all right, so I think we're going to let me take that back. Forget you heard the word, I think. We are now going to stand, and we're going to close with the words, with the song, Ancient Words, is that correct? Ancient Words? All right.